it's going to be a tight 2 days, as you know. So you've gotten your instructions from Hélène about how much time you have at your disposal. And so let's go. Now, the subject of this colloquium is the wisdom of crowds, collective wisdom, the wisdom of the many, whatever you want to call it. As an introduction to the topic, I'd like to cite two opposing views about Athenian democracy. Starting with a passage from James Madison that both Adrian Vermeule and I cite in our papers. Here is the passage. 60 or 70 men may be more properly trusted with a given degree of power than 6 or 7, but it doesn't follow that 6 or 700 would be proportionably a better depository. And if we carry on the supposition to 6 or 7,000, which was, by the way, the typical size of the Athenian assembly, the whole reasoning ought to be reversed. The truth is that in all cases, a certain number at least seems to be necessary to secure the benefits of free consultation and discussion and to guard against too easy a combination for improper purposes. As on the other hand, the number ought at most to be kept within a certain limit in order to avoid the confusion and intemperance of a multitude. In all very numerous assemblies of whatever character composed, passion never fails to wrest the scepter from reason. Had every Athenian citizen been a Socrates, every Athenian assembly would still have been a mob. So maybe he had in mind the Sicilian expedition or something like that. Now, in a book that's coming out in the fall by Joshua Ober, Democracy and Knowledge, he argues for pretty much the opposite view. He claims that as a society, Athens was sufficiently complex to make it interesting to students of the contemporary world. Indeed, it is possible to speak without whimsy or paradox of ancient Athens as in certain ways modern. Of course, one need not be a political scientist, political theorist, ancient historian, or social scientist to regard the success of democratic Athens as an interesting puzzle. How could a system of policymaking by open discussions in public assemblies attended by hundreds of thousands of non-expert decision makers have contributed so much to the glory that was Greece? So clearly he has a diametrically opposed view as that of Madison. In his book, Ober demonstrates the many mechanisms by which the Athenians organized and harnessed the dispersed knowledge of citizens for public ends. Let me just mention as one remarkable example, the reforms of Cleisthenes around 508 BC. As one of these reforms, he created a wholly new set of tribes, each of which was made up of several non-contiguous small units or demes, some from the coastal area, some from the inland area, and some from the city of Athens. In this way, the strong ties that linked members of a deme were supplemented by weak ties to members of other demes, a process that enabled the Athenians to break out of their previous parochial mindsets. Unfortunately, we learned about Ober's work too late to invite him to this conference, but it tells me that he'll be happy to contribute a chapter to the book that we hope will come out of the colloquium. Now, I don't think anyone at the colloquium will actually represent or defend Madison's views. Many other presenters will present ideas closer to Ober's view, namely that citizens who as individuals fall short of Socrates in wisdom may as a group produce better solutions than Socrates by himself would have been able to come up with. There is, of course, a third possibility, namely that the decisions made by a group of ordinary citizens would reflect the shared biases of its members. To take an example from my own field of study, constitution making, after the fall of communism, the ethnic majority in Bulgaria and Romania produced constitutional drafts that were heavily biased against the Turkish and Hungarian minorities. There was little collective wisdom at work in that process. The idea of a collective that we're discussing here can obviously be taken in many senses, ranging from small groups to a national electorate or even the international community. And there may even be a temporal dimension, as when you talk of the wisdom of the ages. One might argue, for instance, that proverbs embody the collective wisdom of many generations, or that a common law is the accumulated wisdom of many judges over time. Whichever level we study, it seems to me that collective wisdom can be decomposed into good values and smart beliefs. It's obviously easier to address the second component, because in the case of beliefs, there is a fact of the matter by virtue of which they are true or false. Yet the decisions made by the collective ought also to promote, in some sense, the good of the collective. As I argue in my own paper, the impartiality of the ends matters just as much as the instrumental rationality of the means. A recurrent theme in many papers concerns the relation between diversity and wisdom. Whereas it seems plausible that diversity of individual beliefs may promote smart group beliefs, it is a more open question how diversity of individual values affect the quality of group beliefs and the quality of group values. To mention only one aspect of the problem, with reasonably homogeneous preferences, that is, non-diverse preferences of individuals, the paradoxes of cyclical collective preferences are less likely to arise. Well, these were just some scattered, improvised remarks, and I now give the mic to Adrian Van Rooy.